The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now.
Hello and welcome to you all. This is another live Clubland Q&A. My name is Andrew Lawton, not Mark Stein, not Laura Rosen Cohen. I am the guest host to the guest host, checking in with you for an hour of substitute guest host level excellence in question answering, or at least so I hope. It is just after 3 o'clock Eastern time where I am in lovely Ontario, Canada. Well, sometimes just lovely, but in keeping with tradition, it is 7 a.m. Wednesday morning in Baker Island. It is just after 9 a.m. in Papeete in French Polynesia. It is noon hour in Vancouver and also Seattle and also San Francisco. If you are wading through the urban feces to perhaps get to your nice lunch restaurant, if they have any nice lunch restaurants in San Francisco, well, we can talk about that a little bit later on. It is just after 1 o'clock in Guatemala City and Tegucigalpa, Honduras. And we can skip ahead, of course, where it is 4 o'clock in Buenos Aires. And where is this? Well, 7 o'clock in Accra. I wasn't asking where Accra is. I was asking, you know, where it was on my list of time zones, because shockingly, I don't do this all from memory. It is 7 o'clock in Rabat and 8 o'clock in Dublin, which is going to be hopefully a lovely evening for you Irish folks that are tuning in. And we can, of course, skip ahead to 9 o'clock in Oslo, 2 a.m. in Bangkok. We did a big jump there. And it is in Adelaide, 5:32 a.m. Thursday morning, and in the Chatham Islands, 8:47. So we have that nice three-quarter hour time zone there. But wherever you are on this planet, I thank you for tuning in. We'll take your questions if you are a Mark Stein Club member. And hopefully if you, well, I mean, hopefully you agree with everything I say, but if not, you can log your objections as we go, and I'll try to rebuff your rebuttal. We'll do either way there, or perhaps all of the above. I always say that I don't want to go too heavy on the Canadian content, and then there's this strange, mysterious effect that Canada has on people around the world, so they tend to ask a lot of Canadian questions. So this time, I'm not even going to do the pretense. If you want to ask Canadian questions, ask them. If you don't, and we will take them as they come. Chris Davies, who I believe is one of our flagship United Kingdom members, says, "Andrew, I hope you are well. Is J.K. Rowling's evisceration of the Scottish hate crime bill the last nail in its coffin, or simply a case of her being too rich to sue?" So this has been quite fascinating. J.K. Rowling has done this transition, but she's done this shift from being this darling of the left, the most talented success story in the world, and then she comes out and says that a biological man can't be a woman, and all of a sudden she becomes this far-right hate monger. And despite all of the backlash, people whose careers and fortunes and lives she is responsible for have turned around and said they want nothing to do with her. But what's been interesting is that she has been unflinching throughout this journey. And I shared something on Twitter, or X as it's now called, a few months back. It might have been more than a year ago now, where I said every day, and I was being a bit dramatic there, it's not every day, but often I will wonder when I'm going to wake up and log online and see the groveling apology from J.K. Rowling for all the harm that she's caused, and she didn't mean it and all of that. And I no longer fear that. Now, maybe I'm asking for trouble because I'm letting my guard down, but I used to fear that, because that's the way it goes for all of these people. You actually think that there is such a thing as being too rich to sue, or too powerful to condemn, too powerful to prosecute. But this doesn't actually stop a lot of people. One example that stands out is John Cena. Now, John Cena is no J.K. Rowling. I'll say first and foremost, he was a pro wrestler, and I saw on Netflix this horrendous movie that he was in because he's a horrendous actor, but he is a chiseled specimen of a human being, so he gets cast in roles that I would never get cast in. John Cena is quite big in China for whatever reason. I don't know if they're like pro wrestling or they like crappy action movies, but he made a comment. This was, I think, a year or 2 years ago, in which he remarked on Taiwan as a country. Now, he wasn't making a political point. He just said that Taiwan is the first country that can watch a certain movie. Because in Taiwan, it was however many hours ahead of North America, and Taiwan happened to have the movie out before anyone else did. That was what he said. It's the first country. No political point, no politics, nothing about China, but he had stepped in it by calling Taiwan a country. Now, Taiwan, as you know, is a place that is, I mean, up until yesterday, the biggest threat facing it was China and is China. And this earthquake that has claimed a number of lives is absolutely horrendous, and I wish the country the very best. Yes, I said country. I wish the country the very best in its recovery. But John Cena, big Hollywood tough guy, pro wrestler, could, you know, take probably like 50 people down in a fight without any thought whatsoever. But he makes a comment like this, angers the Chinese Politburo. And what does John Cena do? He turns around and does this groveling apology in Mandarin. He literally did a groveling apology in Mandarin just because he was so sorry that he called Taiwan a country. Now, again, John Cena is no J.K. Rowling. I'm not at all putting them in the same boat, except to say that what's the point of being rich and powerful and famous if you are just as powerless as the people who don't have your money and your fame and your platform and your prominence? And this is the problem that I have with what a lot of these Hollywood types say. They all claim to be victims. They all claim that they don't really have any agency. This was why you saw very big names, very successful, famous people that said, oh, well, you know, with Harvey Weinstein, I couldn't say no. You had a platform. More people knew who you were than Harvey Weinstein was. So this is, I think, the fascinating thing is that J.K. Rowling, yes, she's made her money. She has what people call colloquially FU money, which means she has money so she can do whatever she wants and doesn't have to think about it. But a lot of these people are not motivated by the money. They're motivated by their place in the official group. You know, your Meryl Streep and your Tom Hanks, your George Clooney, I'm throwing out three random names, but they fit the bill. They have lots of money. But more important to them than the money is to have their place in the club that they want to be a member of. And they don't want to become outsiders. And that's why it actually does, despite her fame and fortune and success, take a tremendous amount of courage for J.K. Rowling to do what she did. Because she has had to accept now that the tribe that she thought she would be immersed in for the entirety of her career as an adult, as a successful author, she has had to accept that that tribe is now dead. And the people who have adopted her are people that she probably holds in a great deal of contempt on a number of issues. She is not a conservative. And, you know, it's interesting, though, she's not yet done, at least in a large enough way, what you see a lot of these people do, which is get really, really uncomfortable with being consumed by the right or being absorbed by the right. And they start saying, well, I'm not them. And they leave themselves with no tribe. She's actually been remarkably self-assured through this entire journey. So anyway, I realize, Chris, I've just gone on like for however many minutes about the essence of J.K. Rowling, but I've been so thrilled that she has not taken any of this lying down. And that's true on the trans stuff. It's especially true on free speech. She faced complaints right out of the gate. Like the first thing that they did when this Scottish hate crime law went into effect, the first thing the activists did was start filing complaints against J.K. Rowling. And she just leaned into it. She was like live tweeting this, you know, desired prosecution of her as it was going on. Police Scotland said, yes, they received the complaints, but they conceded they were not criminal and no further action would be taken. Now, again, if some random person that didn't have J.K. Rowling's money and platform and profile had been doing exactly what she was doing, would police have done the same thing? I suspect not. I suspect they would have gone after it. And I think you can make a comparison between this regime and the one that existed in Canada before Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act was repealed. And it was easy to go after no-name bloggers. It was not easy to go up against people like Mark Stein and Ezra Levant, people who had a profile and a platform and were willing to fight back, that weren't just going to cower in the face of these bureaucrats and censors. So J.K. Rowling has the backing of a lot of people. They, I think, are probably a majority, but it is not a majority of that world that she was for a time at the top of, that arts and culture world, that Hollywood world, that entertainment world. And she's had to say that, you know what, I don't care because this is what I believe and this is what's right. And she, as a survivor of domestic abuse, has very good reasons for believing all that she believes about the importance of female-only spaces, for example. That Humza Yousaf, the First Minister of Scotland, says the bill is about protecting people from a rising tide of hatred. And there are folks that, and he basically says, well, unless you're threatening or abusive, you have nothing to worry about. So his argument is like it is for all of these censors, which is, oh, just trust us. It's the old, if you have nothing to hide, then you have nothing to fear line. If you're not stirring up hatred, you have nothing to worry about. Well, the issue is not what one's motivations are. The issue is not knowing what the government is going to define as hatred, what police are going to treat as hatred. And my goodness, there have already been all these non-crime hate incidents filed against people in the United Kingdom, up and down the UK, because they dared to so-called misgender someone on social media. So it isn't actually that outrageous to imagine that police are at some point under this law going to knock on someone's door for that very same reason. Samantha Smith, who I had the opportunity to spend some time with on the Mark Stein cruise, she's been a guest on Mark's show. She had police in, I think it was Telford, knock on her door because she criticized police on an interview with Mark the night before. And despite all of the sexual assaults and the grooming gangs and the car thefts and the home burglaries and all of that, they put all that stuff on the back burner and said, we've got to knock on the door of this university student because she spoke ill of us in a television broadcast. So J.K. Rowling, I don't think her protest will single-handedly defeat the law. I don't think it will kill it, but I think it will neuter it considerably. I think it will actually take a fair bit of the teeth out of it, and I think it will make police very, very careful, because the last thing some constable in some Scottish community wants to live through is J.K. Rowling putting him on blast because he dared to go knock on someone's door to harass them, or harass them, I should say, about their tweets. Roy Epen, my Canadian compatriot here, Dr. Roy, says, hope you are better, Mark. The Scots have abandoned capitalism and free speech. Do you think this is a byproduct of their growing rejection of Christianity? I actually don't think that's the case. Well, I don't think it's uniquely Scottish. And by that I mean that Scotland is in no way dissimilar to Ireland, and that would offend a lot of people on its own. Let me finish the thought here. Politically, what it's doing is not any different than what Ireland is doing, which is what Canada is doing, what the rest of the UK is doing, what Australia is doing, all of these countries. So can you trace it back to an abandonment of Christianity? It's possible, but I think they're certainly coming from the same place. I don't know whether it's causal or simply a matter of correlation. I think that in general, there's an abandonment of liberty, the idea that we should be individuals who are free, free to think, free to do, free to act. This is not something that is widespread in the Western world. So I think it's an example that is first off a Western phenomenon and not just a Scottish phenomenon. Because it's the same as the COVID issue. When you see the same dynamics taking place in pretty much every Western nation in the world, save for perhaps one or two, or not even that much. I mean, you know, a couple of counties in Florida and Sweden. That was basically the Western world's backstop against COVID insanity. But when you see that happening everywhere, you can't just look at it in isolation. And I think, yes, if you live in Canada, you have to look at what the Canadian government is doing. And if you live in Austria, you have to look at what the Austrian government is doing. But I think in general, we can't localize these things too much. There is a global force underway that is pushing against free speech. And once free speech is gone, there is really nothing else left because you can't debate or discuss anything of substance. You can't protect women's only spaces, which is one political debate, if you don't have the free speech rights to have that debate. And that's what's happening here. Here is a question from KD, not Katie. That's KD is in Kraft Dinner. I think, is Kraft Dinner just a Canadian thing, or do they have Kraft Dinner in America? I actually don't know. I see Jacinda Trudeau is suddenly hot for curbing immigration and reducing the number of temporary workers. Is this him realizing his policies were bad for the country or simply trying to turn his personal poll numbers around? So I was talking about this on my show just a little over an hour ago, in fact. So in Canada, we have Justin Trudeau, who infamously had posted on social media, I think it was 3 years ago, 4 years ago, whenever it was, might have been longer, hashtag welcome to Canada. And this was a tweet from Trudeau that legitimately led to an influx in refugee claims. The exact tweet was, to those fleeing persecution, terror, and war, Canada will welcome you regardless of your faith. Diversity is our strength. This was on January 28th. I was way off in the timeline. January 28th, 2017. So this was basically 1 week after what was it? So Donald Trump had won in 2016. He was inaugurated. Was it January 20th or January 21st? And he takes this stand, which was a very direct shot, or he didn't mention it, so I guess it was a little bit direct, shot at Donald Trump and the United States. Now, this led to demonstrably, and there are government records conceding this, people that were in the U.S. illegally, that were fearing deportation under Trump, just deciding to walk up north. There was this one border crossing between upstate New York and Quebec. It was called Roxham Road. It was not actually a border crossing. It was just a road that dead-ended on one side and picked up on the other side. And in the absence of an official border crossing, it became this illegal highway for illegal immigrants into Canada. And there was a law on the books called the Safe Third Country Act, which said that if you were in the U.S. and you went to Canada, you couldn't claim asylum there because you were already in a safe country. And the exception to that was that the Safe Third Country Agreement or Act, whatever it was called, only applied to people going through an official crossing. So there was an incentive to cross illegally. So Justin Trudeau stoked that, incentivized it further with his tweet. And every policy he's made since he became prime minister has been against securing the border, against reining in large-scale immigration. Now, Canada is a country that, like many other Western nations, has a dismal birth rate. It's below the replacement rate. The only population growth that exists in Canada is from immigration. And there's generally been a consensus between liberals and conservatives in that immigration is important. It's important to the economy. It's important to the cultural fabric of Canada. That's been a consensus that held through Stephen Harper's conservative government and through the earlier years of Justin Trudeau's government. Now, that consensus has changed a fair bit. Because in Canada, people are looking around and seeing that they can't afford a house, they can't find a job, they can't find health care, and people are souring on immigration as a whole because we've had rapidly increasing immigration numbers in this country, which are, I mean, Canada has about 40 million people. We're taking in 500,000 permanent residents a year. But on top of that, 700,000 temporary residents. And these are foreign students, foreign workers, people that are here on a temporary basis, but that's still several years and it's still every year. So it has to factor into the overall migration numbers in the country. So the question from KD here, and I've given you the backstory on this, is that yesterday Justin Trudeau admitted for the first time that I've ever heard this in the time that he's been there, that Canada has had an immigration problem. He said there was a massive spike, and it resulted in more, far beyond, he said, far beyond what Canada was able to absorb. So Justin Trudeau is using what, you know, 5 minutes ago he would have dismissed as racist right-wing talking points when he now says that there were too many immigrants in Canada for what Canada could sustain. So I have a theory on the why. My theory on the why is that conservatives are right now, led by conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, the apple muncher, conservatives are right now in a bit of a tricky spot because the conservatives actually have a fair bit of support from a lot of the ethnic communities in Canada. And these communities, many of them are very pro-migration. They want their family members to be able to be brought in. They want their friends to be able to be brought in. Yes, you get some people that are kind of like shut the door behind them on immigration, but a lot of them say, no, 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 they want chain migration. They want families. So when there is policy that is trying to restrict this, they get a little bit, they get their backs up against the wall a bit. So right now, the Conservatives are courting a lot of these ethnic communities' votes. Pierre Poilievre is going to the Sikh temples, the Hindu temples. He's talking to all of these different communities. And he's taken a bit of a timid approach when it comes to what his immigration plan specifically is going to be. He said, yeah, we're going to tie it to availability of housing and tie it to availability of jobs and all of that. But he's not given the number. He's not said the Liberals have committed to a number that is too high. He's just said that they've committed to a number that's arbitrary. So is he doing this because he just doesn't want to give the Liberals the opportunity to attack him for being racist? Is he doing it because he doesn't know? Or is he honest when he says, listen, this is the formula that I'm going to use. Whatever number it yields is what we're doing. It may be higher, it may be lower. I don't know. I think it's probably a bit of all of these things. But the Liberals have a weird opportunity in front of them to kind of outflank the Conservatives on immigration. So Trudeau can be the guy to say, well, yeah, you know what? Come to think of it, we do have too many immigrants in this country, and then force the Conservatives to either agree or disagree or just put a wedge in between them and much of their base. And this is going to be a bit interesting to watch because I actually don't think this was a misspeak on Justin Trudeau's part. I think he was very deliberate in carving out this position now. Now, the part that's a bit amusing about this is that the guy has been at the helm of the country for 9 years. The guy has run the government for nine years. So when he says that immigration has led to this situation here, he is missing the fact that he is the reason for that. He's trying to kind of claim that it is just this weird passive thing, that it just sort of happened. You just woke up one day and these were the immigration numbers. But realistically, he has been single-handedly the reason for this. He has been the single factor in guiding and directing Canada's immigration policy. And, you know, quite frankly, it's going to be very difficult for him to weasel his way out of this. I think he's getting desperate right now. One thing that I will point out is that the Liberals, like if you don't follow Canadian polling, you can be forgiven because I'm Canadian and even I don't want to, but the Liberals are in an absolute free fall in terms of their numbers. Like if you, I'll look at the one, there was one I saw earlier today. Just give me one moment. I'll pull this up. There it is. So yeah, the Conservatives are at 48% in Ontario. Now, Ontario is central Canada. It's home to the biggest city in Canada, Toronto. It's got a lot of these ethnic communities. It's got a lot of urban areas. So when the Conservatives are in basically the swing territory, I guess it's Canada's Ohio in terms of being a bit of a bellwether, notwithstanding some local differences here. But when the Conservatives are doing that well in a place like that, this is not looking good for the Liberals. So he's desperately clinging to whatever he can. And I think he just sees a weird glimmer, a weird opportunity to carve out a bit of a niche for himself on immigration. And it only works if people forget that he's been the guy in charge for the last 9 years. Here's the next one. Matt from upstate New York. We have some more Canadian content here. I still can't get over the upstate New York. So Matt, you could actually just take Roxham Road up north and be Matt from lower Quebec. I still can't get over the numbers of people killed under Canada's MAID program. As Marcus pointed out, California, with the same number of people and a similar program, has killed a fraction of the number Canada has. Is this all about the numbers, killing people to save the government money? It doesn't seem to be born from a desire to help people. Well, it's a downer of a topic, but it's an important one. And I think I talked about this on the last Q&A I guest hosted, or it might have been a couple ago. But basically, Canada has committed to giving the most radical voices on MAID, or assisted suicide, as we used to call it, exactly what they want. So when the Supreme Court first said, yeah, the prohibition on MAID is not constitutional, I mean, it was a pretty big move, but they put a couple of guardrails into the decision that effectively said, yes, but it should be using these situations, in these circumstances only. And there were a few conditions that ended up being adopted into policy. One of them was that you had to have a foreseeable death. You had to be dealing with grievous and irremediable harm. You needed to basically have a terminal condition that was going to kill you, that was worsening, and you had to be in unbearable pain. And, you know, immediately the activists pounced on this and said, oh, this is too high a threshold. No one's going to qualify. It was basically just for people with ALS and, you know, late stage cancer and MS. And, you know, a lot of Canadians were probably on board in those circumstances because no one wants to see a family member or a loved one suffering, especially if you're not able to access adequate palliative care or just adequate care in general. But then they went further and further and further. And now what's happening in Canada, this is not conjecture, this is not hyperbole, these are literal cases. You have people who are being offered MAID because they have housing insecurity. One woman was offered MAID when she asked for a chairlift. She asked Veterans Affairs Canada for a chairlift to help her get up and down the stairs in her home. And she was asked, oh, it sounds like your life's really crappy. Do you want to end it instead? People have been offered assisted suicide when they have no medical condition whatsoever, let alone one that reaches that threshold that I just described, which is still technically on the books. You have a government now that is trying to advocate for and has passed a law that will soon make it so that you can get assisted suicide if you are mentally ill, if you have depression, say, and you are dealing with your depression and it's very difficult to you and you're having trouble with it, that is now something that can be treated by having your life taken by the government, your life taken by the state. Now, call me old-fashioned. It used to be if someone was dealing with mental illness and they wanted to end their life, we viewed that as a symptom that needed to be treated, not as a request that the government would facilitate. So I think what's happening here is that, yes, there is a regulatory environment that is allowing this. And I would point out that a lot of the assisted suicide horror stories in Canada are not actually complying with the laws or complying with the regulations. The issue is that no one's enforcing the regulations, that they're far too lax. Everyone knows a doctor who knows a doctor who can get MAID for pretty much anyone and everyone. It's the same. I mean, gender transitions are very similar, where you have people in Quebec. There was an expose a few weeks back on this, where some teenager goes in, and after like a five-minute consultation, the doctor's saying, all right, well, I can put you on puberty blockers, and we can get you a referral for a mastectomy if you'd like. And this is just being offered to people all willy-nilly in the same way that now assisted suicide is. And the problem is that the regulations don't matter if you have a culture that allows this. And I think the Canadian medical establishment has, with very few exceptions, decided that this is the direction it wants to take. Canadian society has, they're mortified when they learn about this, but you have so many people that just aren't part of the discussion because the activists have been the only ones at the table, so they've tended to get their way. And it's been quite horrific. And in Canada, it is only going to get worse. Nicola Timmerman, will anyone take that checkbook away from Justin Trudeau? Help. Well, right now, no, is the answer to that. I mean, if there is an election in 2025, as there's supposed to be, the Conservatives are probably going to win it. He'll take the checkbook away. But in the meantime, nope, he's got all the support he needs from his friends in the New Democratic Party. Alisa Angel writes, Andrew, is there a war on freedom of speech and expression across the West? If so, who is waging the war and why? And who is winning? Now, funnily enough, I think from the timestamp on this, Alisa posted this just before the show began. So this was before I was talking about the resistance to free speech in my response to Chris Davies earlier. But it's a big question. Short answer is, yeah, well, no, so I'm going to say, I was about to say yes, but I'm going to say no for a technicality. The question was, is there a war on freedom of speech and expression across the West? I may be getting too much into semantics here, but I'd say in order for there to be a war against it, it has to have a dominant enough presence in the first place to be worth waging a war against. I actually think that the war on free speech and expression across the West has already been won, and freedom was not on the winning side. Freedom was not the winning team. I think that now freedom of speech and expression exist in these little pockets, these little resistance groups behind enemy lines, but really the war is over. So to get to the second part of it, who was waging the war and why, and who is winning? Well, I think it's about who's already won, and that is the censors. The why I'm trying to write a book on, and I'm struggling because I'm still trying to figure out exactly the why. I've got some ideas, and to be honest, I've just started reading Eric Fromm's Escape from Freedom, which I'm only about 85 pages in, but it's quite a fascinating book because his sort of whole look at this is about wondering why people give up their freedom, wondering why people willingly abdicate their freedom. And it isn't just freedom of speech, it's the individual in general. And he talks about it in the context of fear. People fearing what their individualism will get them, people fearing what responsibility will get them. And as a result, if you bring it to a modern context, it becomes easier, a lot easier, for someone to live their life by abdicating their decisions, their identity, their freedoms to a higher power, and that higher power is the state. Imagine if you're someone who is disgusted with cancel culture and you don't like that people are getting canceled for what they say. You have two options. You can self-censor and say, all right, well, I'm not going to say all these things. You can say, well, to hell with it, I'm going to say it anyway and pay the price. Or you can do what a lot of people are doing, which is that, well, I don't want to self-censor. What if I just let government censor? What if I let government restrict my speech? And it's easier to do that because all of a sudden you don't feel like you are an agent in this. You aren't making a decision to self-censor. You're not making a decision to, damn the consequence. You're saying, oh, well, it's illegal. What do you want me to do? It's illegal to say that. It's illegal to do that. And when governments make those decisions for you, you are lulled into this place where you don't have autonomy. You don't have a choice. You didn't really choose to be there. You're just sort of there and you just comply or don't comply. But most people, as we saw during the pandemic era, ultimately go along with complying. And then when they're just in their little private gatherings, they'll say, oh, well, that was a bit stupid. And that's that. So I think that this is a key part of it. People just want the easy way out. Now, I've quoted this in the past. Jordan Peterson had said, he said it in an interview with me first, I believe, and then he repeated it elsewhere, and it's quoted elsewhere now instead of on my show. But he said, look, you're not going to be able to pick no punishment. He said, you can pick your punishment. You can be punished for speaking out, or you can be punished for not speaking out, but you don't get to pick no punishment. And when you, it's such a disheartening way of viewing the world. But when you wrap your head around it, it's almost liberating in a way because you say, okay, well, if there's no path in which I don't get punished, then I might as well pick the one that will let me live my life, live my truth, to use the language of the left, and carry on that way. So the last thing we're left with there in Elisa's question is, who is waging the war? And I think in a lot of cases, no one needs to wage the war because people are willingly surrendering their side as it is. They're just laying down their arms. They're saying, I won't speak freely. And that's that. I think you can look at people in academia. You can look at the special interest groups. You can look at those who have a vested interest in there being no debate and there being no free speech. And those are people who are wrong. People who are wrong. And look at the gender stuff. I mean, if you have a sensible discussion about, oh, biological men in women's sports, about biological men in women's change rooms, in gyms, if you followed any of the stuff that's going on with Planet Fitness now, this is a gym that has decided that it doesn't care about people waving it doesn't care about women waving their penises around in women's change rooms. So take from that sentence what you will. But all of this is to say that when you look at these issues that are happening and you are confronted with, why can't we talk about it? Why are we not talking about it? You've already lost because now you have to start from a step back. So who has a vested interest in there being no debate on that? It's people that couldn't win the argument if there were a debate. They're the ones waging the war on shutting down freedom of speech first and foremost. Brian from Minneapolis says, Dear Andrew, did you watch anything special on Easter weekend? I saw the Ten Commandments on Saturday on local TV. I always end up asking what we have become as a society after seeing it and question my own faith. Then I see the protests in Israel over Gaza. Why won't people understand that? This started as a lighthearted question about what did you watch on TV over the weekend and has ended with the quite horrific realities of the Middle East right now. Why won't people understand that the people who kidnap, rape, torture, and murder them aren't looking for peace with them? If they don't like what they're seeing in Israel, they're free to go to the Arab world and see how long they'd last. Yeah, there's a friend of mine who used to be a radio broadcaster in Winnipeg, Dahlia Kurtz, who had basically posted on social media the other day that she'll pay for anyone in Pride Toronto, which just came out with a statement in support of Hamas, effectively. She said she'll pay for any of them who want to go to Gaza to go there. No strings attached. She'll send them on a plane to Gaza. And I don't think anyone's taken her up on her offer yet. Did I watch anything special on Easter weekend? Nothing Easter related. My wife and I right now are watching this show, The Handmaid's Tale, which is an adaptation of Margaret Atwood's book, which I confess, despite being Canadian, I've never read. And part of that is because I assumed it would be just this profoundly preachy, anti-Christian book. And it may or may not be. The show is actually quite well done. I mean, obviously, there's a subtext. I mean, my read on the show is that it's basically modeled saying, okay, let's take the Iranian Revolution and pretend it was like American right-wing Christians that were behind it. So there's some artistic license there, but it's not an exceedingly preachy show, and it's actually quite well done, and I shouldn't say it was particularly Easter-themed, but I did watch a couple of episodes of that on the Easter weekend. On the Israel side, look, I mean, I've been absolutely pro-Israel for many years of my life. And the more I've learned about Israel, the times I've had the opportunity to go there, the more strengthened in that resolve I've become, because the more I've understood about what Israel is and what Israel has to deal with. And, you know, it's fascinating because I've had this conversation even on this Q&A where you assume that you can have a factual discussion about this. You can say, well, hang on, you know, let's talk about the Six Days War, and let's talk about the Yom Kippur War, and let's talk about this, and let's talk about what settlements actually are, and let's talk about this. But no one on the anti-Israel side is interested in a real discussion about this. No one is interested in it. They want to use all these euphemisms and code words. They want to say that, oh, no, we're not against Jews, we're against Zionists. And they can't really explain how a Zionist differs from a Jew. They just know that it's a trendier thing to say they oppose that isn't as mired in direct condemnations as being anti-Semitic. So a lot of these people are who back Hamas, people that Hamas would have no time for, people who are members of sexual minorities, people who are members of, people who are just non-Muslims. They are, as I've said in the past, they have constructed a world in which decolonialism is the only thing that matters. So they look at everything through that lens, and they decide to try to find some ham-fisted way to turn the Gaza situation into a decolonial struggle or an anti-colonial struggle, and in doing so, they end up in this horrendous situation where they are forced to say that it is virtuous to paraglide into Israel and kill people and rape women and do unspeakable things to infants. This is now what they are defending. And at that point, you can't really have a discussion with anyone about anything of substance, can you? Let's see here. We've got a message from George Pereira, who says, Andrew, you may have heard there is an eclipse on Monday. Yes, I think I heard a song about that, actually. What is baffling to me is the level of hysteria that continues to grow and surround the event. Besides and beyond the usual warning to not stare at the sun directly, we have been warned to make eclipse plans, have extra cash on hand, have an eclipse evacuation plan, have a pride. I haven't gotten any of these memos, and I'm in the path of totality. Have a predetermined meeting eclipse gathering place for friends and families. We should also have some extra milk and bread on hand. The FAA is issuing eclipse flight warnings. Prisons are locking down prisoners who are in turn suing the prisons for violating their religious rights. Others are proclaiming the eclipse in conjunction with the arrival of a comet will presage massive earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. Cats and dogs will be sleeping with each other. I'm baffled by all of this. Yes, it's Y2K all over again, isn't it, George? Who says, and in today's highly partisan environment, is this all Trump's fault and will he be indicted for it? Well, didn't Trump look at the eclipse last time around? I seem to have a vague recollection of him not wanting to put on the silly eclipse glasses, although that might have been some, you know, meme that circulated and not reality. But yeah, I have heard a little bit of the eclipse hysteria. So there's actually Niagara Falls, Ontario, declared a state of emergency about the eclipse. And I'm not entirely clear why it was an emergency. And they declared this several days ahead of time, but they figured out, like, okay, we need to just declare this so that we can have all of these resources available to us, and we'll have some more mechanisms that we can use if roadways get snarled. Like, Niagara region is basically declaring an emergency because they know it's going to be the tourist capital where everyone's going to go, even though you'll probably just see the eclipse fine by, you know, pulling over on the highway and looking up. I don't know why you need to be in Niagara region or Niagara Falls. I wondered as this happened if this was a bit of a civil liberties issue because you are preemptively declaring an emergency for something that hasn't yet happened that's not likely to cause any real harm. And then, of course, I'm not a lawyer, but a friend of mine who is ended up writing a National Post piece saying that it's actually unlawful to preemptively declare an emergency in this way because a solar eclipse is not an emergency. But as we've learned in the last few years, pretty much anything and everything can be an emergency if you try as hard. So, yeah, I don't know where eclipse fever is, but I imagine we're just a couple of rungs short of Y2K levels of panic, George. So I hope you have your eclipse plan in place and all your eclipse MREs ready to go. We got a couple of messages for Mark here that I won't pretend to be able to answer. Timothy McDonald writes, big picture question from the provisional wing of the Wegmans Shoppers Loyalty Program. This is, of course, a reference to the infamous Wegmans glare that our friend Michael Mann got, which was representative of the esteem in the community that he felt had lost because someone gave him a dirty look in the, you know, aisle nine or whatever. Regarding the prosecution of Raisha Blommestein in the Netherlands on hate crime charges, a March 25th story in Before It's News reads like how a certain occupying force in the 1940s gathered information on the citizens of the Netherlands in order to frighten the population into submission. A quote from the article here, her personal data in the population register is regularly queried by ministries, police, and the National Gendarmerie Police. The legal commentator discovered this herself last year through her own inquiry at the National Identity Data Service. Until March of 2022, the queries were still sporadic, but since then, the number of inquiries has increased explosively to an average of one every 3 days. This would amount to 180 inquiries over 1.5 years. Blommestein suspects this has to do with her activist work. So Raisha, I've actually met. She's a good friend of Eva Vlaardingerbroek, and she was on the Mark Steyn cruise. She has found herself targeted based on reasons. I mean, the reasons never seem to matter in Europe. And she's actually quite a lovely and respected commentator in her own right. But the thing about this that I find interesting, and I don't pretend to know the ins and outs of the Dutch situation here, but the problem, it goes back to the J.K. Rowling Scotland thing. The problem is always what they define as hate. And to be honest, in the case of Raisha, and like I said, I don't know the specifics of the case, but the issue to me is a bigger one here. If this is what happens if all of your data and identifying details and, heaven forbid, your banking information are centralized, is that it allows these weaponized processes to be used against you. So Timothy asks, what do you think the verdict and penalty will be? I don't know those answers, but it will probably be, to go to our previous points, not on the side of freedom of speech. The notorious Mr. J writes, I have an observation and a question about popular culture, specifically pop music. Wherever you go nowadays, nearly every public place is bombarded with piped music overhead. Often I wish it wasn't. It's nice to be able to hear yourself think. Oh yeah, no, I'm a total bore on this because when I'm out at a restaurant, nothing turns me off more than live music when I didn't want it because I presumably have gone to a restaurant to be able to talk to someone that I'm dining with. What is interesting is that it usually is not the current top hits, but stuff decades old. And no, they can't be doing it for old geezers like me, because most of the people around are several generations younger. When I talk to the young, I find that many are quite knowledgeable about the music of their parents and grandparents and might hold it in higher esteem than the mass-produced, maybe even AI algorithm-generated pablum of today. This may just be old folks' nostalgia talk. But conversely, there might just be something to it. So it's kind of interesting on this, because one question that I have always had about this is, what of the music today will people listen to in 20, 30, and 40 years? I was, driving around, and I have Spotify in my car, and, I have a Spotify account on my phone, which connects to the car, which is a story of no used to you. But anyway, Spotify, you can just say, just give me a mix. And it'll say, based on stuff you've listened to, we think you'll probably like this random sampling of songs. And I have pretty eclectic music tastes. I'll listen to country. I'll listen to opera. I'll listen to trashy 90s pop. I listen to different things. And the thing about it that I find interesting is that, I'll skip a lot of songs. I don't skip when Tiny Dancer comes on by Elton John. I don't skip when Let It Be comes on by the Beatles. I don't skip when Take It Easy by the Eagles comes on. These old songs that have withstood the test of time, that everyone can sing along to, that are still tremendously popular, and I think people will still be listening to in 10, 20, 30, 40, and 50 years to some extent. And, the crap that is produced today, most of it will not. Now, some will. I'm sure there are some Celine Dion songs that will last. I think probably Lady Gaga and Justin Bieber, you may not like them, but I think a lot of their stuff is culturally relevant enough that it'll be around in many, many years. But the issue is that there is no staying power for a lot of it. And I think one of the issues is that it used to be quite difficult to go through that process of producing. You had to produce in a studio. There were only so many studios available. You had to do it on tapes. Actually mixing it together was a convoluted process. So you had to know or believe significantly that something was going to be good to invest the time, energy, and effort in making it happen. Where's that barrier now? Now, I could, with a couple of free or very cheap computer programs, have an entire recording studio at my fingertips. I could mix, I could do all of this stuff. There's a website I was playing around with last week that I just learned about where you can actually make AI-generated song. I should have come up with an AI-generated song for the show today, but I didn't know the question was coming. You can make AI-generated songs. And to be honest, they don't sound all that different from a lot of the pop you'd find on the radio, which is probably more of an indictment of the pop you'd find on the radio than a compliment to the AI machine. But there's a reason, because music now is by and large following a formula of sorts. So to go back to this, I think that young people are, in a lot of cases, aware, very aware of the fact that that thing they listen to that's older, there's something about it which is good. And they may not know that it's good. They may not know who sings it. They may not know who Elton John is. There was this like horrendous thing a few years back when Kanye West did a song with Paul McCartney. And if you looked on Twitter the day it was released, there were all of these people saying, oh man, good on Kanye for finding new talent. And oh, this Paul McCartney guy is going to be huge thanks to Kanye. And a few of them were probably just trying to have a bit of a lark, but certainly a few were authentic. People that had never heard of Paul McCartney and wouldn't have had Kanye West not decided he wanted to reach out. This was before Kanye West went like just absolutely bonkers on well, a lot of things. But so I think that, you know, Mr. J, the one test here that we have to look at is whether this will all just sort itself out. Because remember, there was a time when people would listen to the Beatles and said, this is not real music. And now we listen to the Beatles and hear it as the music of the good old days, back when music was good. So I think a lot of this is generational to some extent. There was a Leo VT. He, again, touches on something I touched on later on. Just wondering if you have any thoughts on places like Indiana, Niagara Falls, and others declaring a state of emergency for the eclipse. Have we all gone Wiccan now? No, I think it's that during the COVID era, we lowered the bar substantially on what it means to be an emergency. And this is why everyone is saying we need to have climate change emergencies and we need to have flu emergencies. We need to have eclipse emergencies. We need to have all of this. Walter Sorbera writes, Andrew just mentioned the category of sexual minority. What the hell is that? So, okay, let me be perfectly frank here. I didn't make it up. A colleague of mine who is an editor of the Western Standard, which was revived online a couple of years ago. In the Western Standard style guide, they use the term sexual minorities to deal with anyone in the LGBTQ2+IAIIQ community, because they're adding letters to it, they're changing letters, they're moving them around. In Canada, we have a number 2 in the letter. So he said, we'll just call them sexual minorities. And his rationale for this, which I kind of agreed with, was that And I've had this discussion at True North, which is the outlet for which I'm the managing editor in Canada. If we call it the LGBT community, we are including the T, which is often not viewed the same way by the LGB. And a lot of the debates that we see on the trans issue are debates between people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, and debates they're having with or about transgender people or transgender issues or policies. So basically, sexual minorities was just a kind of a catch-all to refer to anyone who identifies as something other than heterosexual for the purposes of diversity and all that. So that was effectively where that term came from. And I'm actually glad you asked on that, because I'm still trying to come up with the lexicon that we can use that isn't just going to be constantly evolving on this. There is a message from Stefan, who writes, Mark, may the Lord bless you and grant you full health during this intertrial period and beyond. I have a question that you may not wish to answer publicly, but here goes. I have gone back and listened to your Rush 3 Years On podcast twice because I miss him dearly, having listened for over 30 years, and also because you were my favorite Rush guest host of all time. My question is, did you have the opportunity to take over his time slot on the EIB network? Was it offered to you and you declined, or were you not ever approached about it? That's more than one question, but even White House correspondents are allowed follow-ups. Thanks for these Q&A sessions, Mark, and Godspeed. So I don't speak for Mark, but I seem to recall, I've heard his answer on this in the past, so I guess I am speaking on his behalf in some way. Mark's view, which I'm inclined to agree as a former talk radio guy myself, was that talk radio had no real future in the post-Rush era. And, you know, there was a lot of truth to that. Rush hosted noon to 3 Eastern time, and you had hundreds of radio stations across the United States that built their entire calendars outwards from that. They found a 9 to 12 guy who would lead into Rush, a 3 o'clock guy for the afternoon drive who would pick up where Rush left off, and that was that. And you had this network of syndicated hosts that built out from there as well, your Sean Hannity's and your Laura Ingraham's and your Glenn Beck's and all of that, but none of them was as strong or as popular as Rush. And, you know, one illustrative point I'll bring up on this is, when was the last time you saw someone share something that was said on talk radio. In my circles, it has not happened in the American talk radio context since Rush died. Maybe like once I saw something on Twitter of, you know, what Clay and Buck or Cluck and Bay, whatever they're called, what they said. But realistically speaking, it's lost the cultural relevance. And part of that is that radio itself was in decline as a medium. I think Rush probably kept radio on life support beyond when it naturally would have lived just because he was so good and he was so popular and so strong. But really, the popularity could not survive the absence of Rush. So I think Mark saw that. He saw the writing on the wall, and I don't think he had any interest in being a part of a medium in decline. That's kind of the sense that I've gotten from that. And also, I mean, this is my own theory. I also don't think Mark doesn't like being tied down in a little windowless room when he could be, you know, sailing the high seas on the Mark Steyn cruise and all of that. So, which hopefully we'll have some news on in the near future about the next Mark Steyn cruise. We just came back a month ago from the Caribbean, and it was tremendous fun. We had a grand old time. And it was quite tragic, actually. So we were on Holland America's New Amsterdam. And that ship, just about a week and a half ago, that ship had two crew members die in a rather tragic steam room incident of some kind when the ship was at Half Moon Cay in the Bahamas, where we stopped. So I don't know who these crew members are. We may or may not have seen them. If they were in the steam room, we probably didn't see them in our travels. But it was on that ship, and I know a lot of the people that we would have worked with were kind of quite rattled by that. So that was the darker side of the cruising world. I think we've got time for one more question here. Kenneth writes, Democrat strategist James Carville, there's a name I haven't heard in a while, James Carville is lamenting that polls show the young and many minorities, especially men, seem to be leaving his party in droves and are supporting Trump. Any thoughts on this? Is that also the case in Canada with Poilievre? So short answer, yes, it is. I think there are two things here. Number one, Democrats and the left in general have always taken their votes for granted. They've always assumed that they'll rely on the women's vote, they'll rely on the minority vote, they'll rely on the youth vote. And look, there's good reason for that. Generally speaking, they have been able to rely on this. But they've not done anything to try to win those people over. Young people in Canada and in the United States cannot afford houses. They are growing up in a country, in a society in which their future is not secure. This is the first generation that is going to be worse off than its parents were financially. And that does not come without a political cost to the establishment. So what's happening here is young people are saying, all right, well, Joe Biden's not serving us. This Trump guy, yeah, you know, maybe he says mean things on Twitter, but maybe he's got the answers. Maybe he does. And in Canada, they're certainly flocking to Pierre Poilievre. So I think absolutely it's the Democrats taking voting cohorts for granted that has really allowed this issue to take hold the way it has. And I think you see this in a lot of ways on, you know, racial minorities, you see it on age minorities, and you see it on women. You know, women did so much better, or like Trump did so much better with women than any political commentators or strategists thought was possible. And the left also has a disadvantage in that they genuinely view their political opponents as evil. So they would assume, well, there's no way these people could vote for Trump. So they don't feel an incentive to try to win over that demographic. And they do that at their peril. That does it for me for today. Hope you have a great rest of the week. Andrew Lawton in for Mark on yet another Clubland Q&A. Thank you, God bless, and good day to you all. We'll be right back.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.